beeping, eh?
Yeah, no, it's, this wasn't button. Closed properly.
Oh, I see.
I just realized that.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, a little. Well, you know, when I went over, it was over in Europe, I've never can imagine, like, I never imagined half of what I've seen, you know, in terms
okay,
of...
Okay, what...
The shocking parts of it?
Yeah. Well, what was shocking?
Well, I've always sort of seen his mama, you know, just a normal mm-hmm. run-of-the-mill mm-hmm. person here. Mm-hmm. When I landed in Heathrow,
mm-hmm.
The very first thing was there was a lot of sort of bomb scares happening as a result of Muammar Gaddafi type stuff, you know, mm-hmm. Libya. Mm-hmm. So their security was very tight.
Yes.
Well, anybody who looked like they potentially Iranians were over to one side, or I guess...
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking that. You've got
Iraqians
this mustache
or whatever. Well, guess who ended up in that group? I was there for an hour until they realized that I was Canadian, had a Canadian passport and all that stuff. And fine, you know, out of there and through, it was fine. But every time I went through a customs office, wherever... I was given extra careful checking. Basically, almost skin searched.
Yeah, you could be taken for a foreign Arab.
I right? could be an Arab. I could be an Italian. I could be a Greek. I could be whatever.
Yeah.
And so I received different treatment, you know, as a result of that. And in London, we received very different treatment as well. As long as we were perceived to be the general rank and file in the public thought that mm-hmm. we were sort of East Indian descent mm-hmm. and treated us very poorly.
Mm-hmm.
When they found out we were North American Indian, they rolled up the red carpet.
Mm-hmm.
Strange, you know, but because we're
well, that's,
not common
that's
there. And
the Indian craze in Germany is even stronger than
is that right?
Is the other side. It's just as racist. It's just mm-hmm. the other side of the coin.
Is that right?
Because we're a very racist country.
Mm-hmm.
The way Turkish people, there are 4 million Turkish people mm-hmm. in Germany. They are at the bottom, and refugees from third world countries.
Oh, right.
There's really a hierarchy, mm-hmm. and. On the other hand, there's this crazy romantic infatuation with all things Indian.
Oh, really?
And they're put on a pedestal.
Hmm.
But that doesn't keep people from being racist against, if they don't know they're native people, just because they're,
right.
they're darker.
Right.
Things like that. Hmm. I mean, it's crazy. It's
isn't
not,
that right, eh?
It's still racist.
Hmm. Kind of strange.
Because it doesn't look at people as people. It looks at people in terms of what their outer appearance is,
right.
or what they romanticize, or they heard in propaganda-wise
yeah.
about them. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, mm-hmm. you know, just some of the things, like I've never been to a people huge cities. Like Winnipeg was the largest city that I've ever been to.
London is a monster.
I am in London. I hop in that tube station and come out of the ground. Like, I've never been underground or one of those things. That was pretty scary, but I had to do it.
Yeah.
I came out in Piccadilly Circus in rush hour. 2 million people in that area. There's more people in that area than there are in my whole province.
Yeah, that's
you
true.
Know?
That's true.
And
yeah.
they all are got their going their own ways on a mission.
Yeah.
And the streets are like, it's like an octopus or a spider web, and they
yeah.
I got lost so many times. And the only way somebody would help you if you stopped them and asked them.
Yeah.
I found that strange. But they're polite.
Yeah.
when I see construction,
mm-hmm.
building construction, people, like here I'm so used to seeing cranes and things
mm-hmm.
like that. There they have ladders and 5-gallon pails and ropes and they pull materials up. And like I suppose maintaining the European skyline or the 500 years of...
Mm-hmm.
The 500-year cities or year-old cities, the streets won't take them. Heavy equipment, they don't have them.
Mm-hmm.
They don't believe in them. The workforce, like I never understood all that. The need for manual labor. Then, you know, you see street construction. Water mains broken and eight or ten guys working on one with
That's
picks and shovels.
That Which country did you go to?
Well, London and Scotland.
Mm-hmm. Did you see that in France, too?
No, I didn't see that in France.
No, you see, that's a different. In Britain, okay, I won't say anything.
Yeah.
I lived in England.
I just found it so strange.
It is.
You know, everything was done manual.
They dig
down in the street with a picks and shovels, where we would just use a bobcat or a crane and be done in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And I was just so amazed by all that.
Did you, you went up to Scotland too?
Yes, just Edinburgh for a couple of days.
Yeah.
I loved it.
Did you, Edinburgh is a very
beautiful
place.
Beautiful
city. I like it too. My sister-in-law, she's from there.
I spent 9 days in Dublin.
Mm-hmm.
What an incredible experience. I stayed in the very poor area of Dublin.
Mm-hmm.
And all the people at the museum and stuff said, you shouldn't stay there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I said, hey, no way. I said, I like it, fine.
Mm-hmm.
But there were people. The scales of poverty were so incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there were people walking into shopping stores that sold dresses for $1,000, and people walking in and out with clothes like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were people laying on the street begging out front of the store.
Exactly.
You know, and alcoholism. I never seen so many guys drunk and lurching down the street in the middle of the day in Dublin and asking to borrow a pound for another beer, you know, stuff like that. It was really incredible. I never seen anything like that. And the travelers, I was quite grossed out by that, because I'm very soft touch with kids. Kids can do anything and get away with it with me, almost. There I am walking around with my camera, and all these kids descend on me. Here's a tourist, he's fair game, and these all the five little kids come, little dirty faced kids asking for money. I gave them all I had every day, you know, here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not long, the word's passed up and down the street, this guy's an easy mark. Well, God, it was just horrible. It got to the point where I couldn't go downtown last week. I just couldn't. So I would just go to the museum and go home after.
Mm-hmm.
But I liked it. I was a tremendous experience, but I was never so happy to come home. I had a hard time getting used to the food, the change in climate, various accents, language, customs,
sure.
You know, all sorts of things.
There's always a culture shock.
Yeah, culture shock. I didn't flow too well with all that. My wife handled it much better than I did. And when I got home, I almost kissed the god darn tarmac at Leicester V in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And Toronto's as foreign, I don't know nothing about Toronto either.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got to Regina, I was really almost giddy. I was so happy to be home. And I hated Regina before going, but now I think Regina's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
It's much cleaner than most the cities I had been at, like certainly much cleaner than London. I had spent a lot of time in London.
Mm-hmm.
And also everything's above ground.
Yeah.
There's elevators all over the place. I never appreciated elevators until I started staying in those bed and breakfasts in London, when you got to go up 6 flights of stairs to your room every night, and when you're lugging 200 pounds of camera equipment,
saying,
right, then it's then it's different. And just some the things we take for granted so much, like heat. We went in the spring, stay in the bed and breakfast, they turn the heat on from 6 till 8. That was it. And
that's for, I think Britain is, heating-wise, the worst place on earth that I've ever been to.
And so if you wanted a hot shower, you had to get up out of bed between 6 and 8.
But that is
standard
procedure.
That
is very much Britain.
Yeah.
I don't know about, I don't know about Ireland, but certainly Britain. The whole heating system or so, it's...
Yeah, the electrical systems, the wires are on the outside.
What do you say about cleanliness and standards? You know, when we came from, we're from Germany. Germany is a very affluent country. We realized how much poverty there is in China. And how much dirt there's flying around, papers and streets.
Yeah.
You don't see that. But there, you see, there's a vast difference in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Then you'll see a lot of other stuff in Germany, which you think, God, this is terrible.
Yeah.
And you always have that. You go to other countries, and of course what you see is what is different.
Right.
Because your perception is framed by where you come from.
Right, exactly.
And usually what strikes you first is what is different in negative terms. Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wherever you go, that's weird.
Like, I don't see the garbage so much anymore around here, but London, it was
London's
really bad.
And or you go up through the north in England. I lived in Manchester for a year.
Worse yet?
That's northern England. Uh-huh. One of the biggest industrial towns, Manchester. Manchester, Liverpool, Birmingham.
Right. I was in Liverpool.
Mm-hmm. Well, Manchester is close to Liverpool. It's a little further inland. Uh-huh. Been to Liverpool, too.
Yeah, it's pretty. I went there just right after, the week after those people got crushed in that soccer.
Oh.
And the town was just in mourning. Like, the whole town was just devastated. It was terrible. So we ended up,
what kind of research did you do?
Well, what I did was, I just went to museums that I had, some of the museums that I had identified as having Métis collections, Métis artifacts. That was my main area of interest.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, my wife had...
Did you find a lot?
You bet. I came home with 1,400 slides.
Jesus.
And, we hit 11 museums.
So you have an archive where you put all that on slides?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how do you catalog it?
I have them all in a DBase computer program.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
And I've got them all. Well, what I found...
Do you do that all single-handedly?
Yep.
That's a lot of work.
Yep. I went to... What I found over there is the majority of people working in the area of... museum type people who are sort of like they're North American ethnographers.
Mm-hmm.
They travel back and forth to North America an awful lot. They know the pieces fairly well. They know a lot about the anthropological perspective of the groups, but they do not understand geography.
Mm-hmm.
They do not understand human nature. And they're also very, very, very independent of each other. They will not share each other's research.
No.
They will not share each other's ideas.
Oh, everybody.
Everybody is always grappling tight on their own information.
Mm-hmm.
So I am quite free and loose with information.
Mm-hmm.
And so as I'm talking to these different people, they're asking me questions and they're writing things down frantically. And I say, well, what is, no problem here. then I get, this is unbelievably strange. And so as I go to these different museums, I find their documentation to be many ways wrong, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the pieces are dated 1840 and they were collected in a certain place, but they will have things identified as being a hood, a child's hood. Well, it has nothing to do with a child's hood. It's something else completely.
Mm-hmm.
Or it would be, they would have things identified as straw.
Mm-hmm.
God, it was be quills or bird quills or stuff, you know. And they would talk about, you know, they would have these things, I would say, they, you know, totally described wrong. They would have them identified as something, and that's not that at all. It's something else. So I didn't bother correcting them. But what I did was, every time I had one of those pieces, I would talk to my wife, take a picture, you know, we'd consult. So what I did was I documented everything that they had, and then the flavor of the language, some of them was just obscene, almost.
Mm-hmm.
Like, used by half-casters in the revolution, or, you know, worn by squaws, and, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
So you just take away all that crap language, and you word it how you want it worded, sort of thing, and just describe it. I measured everything and did everything, so I've entered it all in a computer program. It's taken me over a year to do it. And
do those people over there at the museums, do they get a feedback from you?
I've just written letters back and forth. I haven't bothered. I haven't sent it to them. I will send them a copy of what I've done for their prospective museum. But just because the majority...
Well, the question is how open they are, actually.
Well...
You may send it back and some people say, yeah, so what?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. Well, they can do whatever they will with it, you know.
It would be good to...
Yeah. One of the couple of things that have really been good about that is I've talked quite frankly a lot about, I'm quite open about the idea of saying, well, we don't have a museum in Canada, a Métis museum, controlled by Métis people, or Aboriginal people for that matter, nothing. There's a lot of, there's millions and millions of Métis and Indian artifacts in Canada and the United States and Europe. Museums are full of them, especially in Europe. You know, it's full of them. And
it was part of the rip-off.
Yeah, so my wife and I have sort of, our life goal is to establish a museum in Canada, a Métis museum.
Where would that be?
Anywhere. Anywhere who? Anybody who'd want to support it, I suppose. The majority of the artifacts.
No, I mean, if you all of a sudden, the sky opened and down came so and so many $1 million so you and, could set it up.
I could put it up anywhere.
Where would you put it up?
Well, I think we'd have to put it where it should be. Well, actually, there's a couple of time periods. Like one time period, like we could do two of them to be all wonderful and dreamy. One would be in the Great Lakes area because of that was the parent cultures, the Métis people.
Yeah.
And a tremendous amount of the artifacts are from there. And another, I think, well, I'm partisan. I was born in Saskatchewan. I'd build it at Batoche, you know?
Yeah. What do you think about the museum that is at Batoche now?
Well, I also have a mixed feeling with that. It needed to be done. It's okay. The architecture, adequate. The architect who designed it is a good friend of my wife's. She knew them, grew up in the same town sort of thing, or he worked on it, so I can't say too much negative about it. But I think it could have been more than what it is. I really do. I think they really made a mistake by not even involving Métis people in it.
They didn't.
No. They had nothing to do with it. They.
I think there's one or two employees or maybe three who are Métis. That's it. I've been there three or four times.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm amazed about that. Also, I know that talking to some Métis people in that region, they said, well, now it's for good that there's that church will never be used again.
Yeah.
Because I think until before they opened the museum, so they were occasionally still using the church. And
right.
It's a museum.
Yeah.
So it's not.
Right.
All of a sudden, what is theirs is not even accessible to
right.
them.
Right. Yeah.
They
yeah.
could have paid.
See, I never thought of that.
No.
And you can't go in there. Like, you could always sort of drive reasonably close. Now you got to walk.
Mm-hmm.
To get to the graveyard, you got to walk a half mile back in there, sort of thing. And for older people, that's
a distance. Yeah.
It's a distance, and it's very hard, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So for younger people, it's good for them. But you know, people that that are older, it's much harder. They were not.
Otherwise, if you think of the whole area and the landscape, it's beautiful.
Oh, it's incredible. Yeah.
And it's good that there is a region where you can see. Strips.
Yeah.
I mean, you can, if you go further up the river, you still see that there occasionally too, but a lot of farmers take down the hedges, right?
Whenever I go up there, I feel like, I don't know, I feel really different than I normally feel. Like, I feel a strain, you know, like I can almost feel that those, the people that live, when I go to that graveyard, I really feel a strength, and I really feel that those people in there are still living, like they're watching, they're, you know, they're our conscience in many ways, and maybe it's strange, but I feel that.
Yeah.
It seems that way anyway. At least I believe that anyway. So
it's a very powerful place.
Yeah, very, very powerful.
Yeah.
And a lot of
even if you go to the graveyard in St. Louis, they got Maxime Lépine's grave there, some others under this tree.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty powerful. Now they set up this new big gate, Medrick McDougall Memorial Gate.
Oh, right, okay.
For Medrick. I met Medrick three and a half years ago. We visited with him. He was busy sort of straightening out that cemetery. So we nicknamed him in our minds Metric Metric.
Oh, yeah. Metric, great, okay.
He was so proud of him. He got a hernia because he was lifting those slabs and he was in his 80s.
80s, yeah.
And then we drove around and we went to Duck Lake and he said, I want to check something out. So we went to the graveyard there and sure enough, there were two guys there, two Métis people straightening that out. So we thought, well, there's a whole reform movement going straightening out graveyards. You know, but I don't think those metric parts are the powerful ones, but the older ones, the old graves, there's so much history.
Well, I went, one of the interesting ones is, my wife and I, we and my mother-in-law actually, we have a cabin in Lake Winnipeg. And we head there in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
It was intended as a retirement home for my mother-in-law and my father-in-law.
Where's that?
About 80 kilometers northeast of Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm.
And they bought an acre of land.
Towards Selkirk?
Yeah, north of Selkirk, yeah. Well, they bought an acre of land in the bush several years ago for a couple hundred bucks, sort of thing. Well, my father-in-law was an electrician, and he was always drawing and carving and stuff like that. So he designed this cabin out of logs, and he brought in these logs from Ontario, and he built this 1,000-square-foot cabin as a year-round home, like it was going to be his retirement home. Well, he was going to take early retirement when he was 60. When he hit 59, he got cancer and died. Or he got cancer when he was 55 or 54, and then he died when he was 59. But he ended up doing the brunt of the outside work. Mm-hmm. I've ended up doing all the inside work. And I go there every summer, and I go there in the Christmas time. It's beautiful, good place to be. But I go a lot, and one time, I've forever driven by the White Horse Plains, St. Francis Xavier, now it's called, a little community just this side of Winnipeg, headingly, I go through there. Well, that's Métis, that's Reset Country, years and years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
Métis homeland, all that
you
there.
You know the place called the Narrows? That is, I think, north of at Winnipeg says, I need a map I could show you. And there's the Métis community. There's a reserve, but there's also a Métis community, and I went there. And that was very strong. In front of every plot, they had a sign, sort of Métis local of so-and-so.
All right, okay.
And the name of the people living there, and I was there this summer. I've been there twice, and I think that's a very strong place. That's north. I don't know whether that's the one that you're referring to.
St. Francis Xavier, I drove in, it's just on this side of Winnipeg, there's that big white horse, plastic horse, or clay horse, or whatever the statue. It's just about 10 miles east of Winnipeg, and there's a little sign that says St. Francis Xavier, which is the original community of Cuthbert Grant that he built called Granttown.
Mm-hmm.
And the church mission took it over and ran the mission, and since now it's called St. Francis Xavier. I went there, and go through the phone book, and they don't recognize any Métis names in the phone book. It's just a small community, a couple hundred people. So I went to the graveyard, the old church, and there's the old boys back in there. There's the Pascal Berlands and Pierre Falcons, and so it's that type, you know, those people from the 1700s and 1800s. And that's a powerful graveyard. There's a big cairn erected there, Cuthbert Grant. I'm not sure if he was buried under the cairn or what, but it's an interesting little neck of the world.
Yeah.
But,
I'll show you what that is.
Oh. Well, leave him on. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
Manitoba.
There is a place where you can get through from if you come from Dauphin.
Right, okay.
The Narrows. I don't know exactly where that is. It must be here, north of Lake Winnipegosis. And you go around this, and the community is somewhere there.
Huh.
I forgot. I can look it up. We took some pictures down. I can't recall the name, but that's a very powerful place. And
Camperville?
If you drive there,
huh? Camperville?
No, it's not Camperville. No. If you go there in the summer anyway, yeah. I mean, instead of going down the on the main highway, you can go past Dauphin Riding Mountain.
Right,
or whatever.
Right. We have friends in Riding Mountain. We occasionally drive through there. Right, see our cabin's right there.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
But.
Is beautiful. The narrows there. There's a bridge, and you can get across Lake Winnipeg because it's so narrow there, and.
I want to go to Hecla Island as well.
Huh?
Take the children.
Hecla
Island.
Do you know? that's funny. The reason I went there was I read some novels from that region, right? Mm-hmm. Martha Austensoe's Wild Geese and Gabriel Salverson's The Viking Heart.
Okay.
It's all in that region,
right?
And in 1987, I was here for 5 weeks in Canada, driving around, doing some collecting material on Canadian studies.
Right.
And then in 1989 again. And each time there's a program set up by External Affairs and the Canada Council for scholars from overseas to come to Canada to gather material to teach back home. And I was lucky I got a grant like that twice. So I was here again in 1989, and each time some of my colleagues from Germany, who are also friends, they were here too, at least one of them. And for 1 week, we rented a car together and drove around.
Right.
And one trip was driving around there, and I really liked that region. Oh. It's beautiful. And it's certainly Métis and Indian country. Well, the whole of Canada.
Icelandic, yeah.
Yeah, the whole of Canada. Powerful.
Yeah, it's really a
Yeah, strongly Icelandic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a real mixture of people.
Mm-hmm.
I travel quite a lot to northern Saskatchewan, like doing teaching. Within our Dumont programs.
Mm-hmm.
We've had them at Isle of Cross, Buffalo Narrows, Cumberland House.
Mm-hmm.
So wherever there's a program, I usually end up there for a while doing some teaching, but just the diversity within our own province, within our own people, within our organization is incredible.
Yeah,
it really is. It's what I find ironic was when I was in London, somebody said, "Well, where are you from?"
Mm-hmm.
I would say, "Well, I told them Regina at the start," and they say, "What?" You know?
Yeah, sure.
So I say, "Canada. Oh, I've heard of Canada, right? Yes. Well, what have you heard about Canada?" "Well, I've
it's
heard
cold.
Of Montreal, and I've heard of Vancouver, and I heard it's cold, right?"
Mm-hmm.
So my rationale, my explanation to describe Canada became, Canada is very wide. It takes 10 days in a vehicle driving 60 miles an hour. 8 hours a day will take you 10 days to drive across. They find that really hard to fathom. So the province I live in is in the center. I'm going to quibble a few hundred miles, but somewhere near the center.
Yeah.
The population, the size of the province I live in is you can fit 3 of the entire British Isles within my province.
Yeah.
Wow, it's huge. You know, I said, "No, it's not huge. It's one of the smaller provinces, in fact."
Mm-hmm.
The population is 1 million in the whole entire province. They couldn't believe that. "Well, then you must know everybody." I said, "No." I didn't want to get into an argument about the Saskatoon Regina thing, which one is bigger, which had more people. I said, "I live in the capital city."
Mm-hmm.
It's the largest city in Saskatchewan. There's 165,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they have towns bigger than that in England. They couldn't fathom all this. That we had nothing underground. Everything was wide open. They couldn't believe all this sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the way it is.
Yeah. No, that is something I think that is, if you're European, you come to North America, you come to Canada in particular, what is overwhelming is distances and vastness in the country. It's just incredible.
Yeah.
and how far apart people are, how much space there is.
Sunsets. Right?
Yeah.
A prairie sunset is incredible.
That's what I'll be, well, there are lots of things I'll be missing. I'm sad to go home.
Is that right, eh? Yeah, yeah, I've actually...
what I miss most, I think, actually is the people at SRC.
Is that right? Yeah. Well, that's good. That means you've had a good stay.
Very good.
If you're going to miss people.
Yeah.
I know when I came home...
But also the sunsets in the area, I like that.
When I came home from Europe, one person I missed most is one I'd worked with in Dublin, just a young lady who was very, very helpful to my wife and I in the museum. Mm-hmm. She was just very real, very nice to us, and very helpful. And I think I missed her the most of anybody. But I was, well, quite frankly, you know, a lot when I was over there with people at the curator level, talked about where. About museums, like I said, we want our own museum. I don't know if you've been to the Glenville.
I've been once.
Okay.
In 87, yeah.
Well, I have. The institute has had an ongoing relationship with Julia Harris for quite a few years, and she's a curator. I went and had a meeting with her, and spoke very when she had that Spirit Sings for the Olympics.
Oh yeah, that was a big.
Well, I had a meeting with her. Her and her assistant was Beth Carter. Good people, nice people. I had a good chat with them.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I was quite frank with her when I just said, we want to start our own museum.
Mm-hmm.
We would like your support.
Mm-hmm.
And while you're supporting, we want some of those artifacts. She was appalled that we would even consider that. I said, those aren't yours.
Mm-hmm.
The majority of those have been stolen, or bought for nothing.
Borrowed, never given back,
or whatever. And I said, they don't belong to you, they belong to the people.
Mm-hmm.
Took it very personal. I said, we don't want them all, we'd like a few.
Mm-hmm.
We'd like this is going to be fairly small. So I was
Well, that's going to happen.
Yeah. So
artifacts are going to go back to the countries and to the people.
Right.
No way around that.
Right. So I went to Europe. I talked very frankly with people at the curator level.
Mm-hmm.
Very open to it,
mm-hmm.
very supportive of the idea.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty well, every museum.
It has to happen.
And I talked about three different modes. Like one, you could do it by permanent loan, one thing. A repatriation is another.
Mm-hmm.
And another, I just said, was sell it back to us for what you paid for it. Like, we don't want it all, we just want some. Like, there are so many pieces over there, it's just incredible. We could never.
More than here.
Oh, more. Well, lots more than here.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the state of the economy is so bad over there that all the museums are publicly funded.
Yeah.
And every town is a museum.
Yeah.
And the towns are closing their museums.
Yeah.
You know, and
it's just rotting away somewhere.
Sure, and they're being cut back, so they're donating their collections to the larger museums, or they're selling it on the open market at Sotheby's or Christie's and Sotheby's or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The auction blocks, and the Americans are buying them. And paying too much for it, you know, overinflated and driving the bargains up and the prices up. And, but anyway, I just talked about that quite frankly with them, how we would like to start our own museum with some of the pieces, you know, like we don't want them all by all means.
You know, do you know Dave Miller?
Yeah.
Because he was talking the other day, he thought that, well, this was a couple of months ago, also about this issue, how all the artifacts will be going back to the people, to the communities, to the reserves and so on. And he thought that Native Studies should develop training for curators and stuff.
Oh, absolutely.
That there are enough Native people because one of the arguments against it, now, I once went to... This was just a coincidence. I was at Carleton University in Ottawa, and they had one big guest that was James Axtell. I don't know whether you've ever heard of him. He's a big shot in American studies, Native history in the U.S. Really a very big shot. Wrote some very good books. I mean, a lot of research. But he's so conservative. He's so conceited.
Mm-hmm.
He's really insulting. He said, well, no way, giving back, no way. I've got the power. I've got the money. I pay for it. I've got the right museum. And it stays where it is. That was his answer to questions. He was really obnoxious. But and one of the arguments, of course, that he used and other people will use too, yeah, but there isn't the know-how. I mean, if you know
the
little
shitty facilities.
Museums over in Europe, where the stuff may be just rotting away in some archive, they don't have the facilities either.
No, they don't have the know-how
and
either.
No, exactly. So, yeah. So it's going to happen, mm-hmm. and the more, it's a two-way thing. One is the sort of, I don't know, the ethics or the spirit of it, I think is the most important one. But to get that across, it helps if people can go and say, here, I've got my paper.
Right. I've talked to people at the curator, they're supportive of them. But of course, Britain, Britain don't have a culture of their own. They have nothing. Well, they've got it, they've stolen from other people all over the world, you know. They have no museum identity of their own, no cultural, like, artifact sort of heritage, really.
They have it, but they don't consider it...
Valid at all, sort of thing like that. So, their policy, like, their museums are full of stuff from all over the world. Papua New Guinea.
It was the center of colonialism.
Right. So, if they start giving something back, they're going to have to give everything back. And I know Greece wants those Elgin marbles that Lord Elgin stole.
Yeah.
And
same with Egypt.
Exactly.
Germany has stuff from Egypt. Some of it has been given back, but there's this one bust that Egypt wants back, and the museum in Berlin, they don't want to give it back, and they offered so and so many other pieces instead. Say no, we want that one.
Mm.
So, but it's going to
it will
back.
Eventually.
It will go back. Okay. It will go back.
But since then, I've came home. Mm-hmm. Since I've gone on that one little excursion, I came home. I've been approached by two groups in Canada already. One is my project is an angle.
Mm-hmm.
To build in a museum in Regina, for one, established museum, one group in Regina. And they said, we need an angle. And I said, I'm not going to take it from one colonizer and give it to another one.
I've got a question. I heard something on the radio, I think it was this morning, but only in passing, that the Museum of Natural History has some event this weekend. And I wasn't really listening. It also said something about a native gallery or something like that.
There is talk of building an indigenous gallery there's a board in Saskatchewan sort of thing. But I know there's a little museum in Old City Hall, across the street from the Cornwall Center. You must have, you may have even been in the museum. It's a small museum. They've got a lot of
The planes.
I
haven't been there. My family's been there.
Quite a few. Mm-hmm. That's one of the ones that approached me and are interested on opening up. They have 5
That's
million.
A very small one.
Yeah, they have $5 million in a string from federal government to build to convert the VIA rail station, for example, into a museum.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I won't take it from one colonizer and give it to another. I said, the only way I'm interested is if we have Aboriginal people who are the curators, Aboriginal people who are the janitors, Aboriginal people who are repairing the things, looking after them, building the climate control boxes.
Because that is a white middle class thing.
Well,
right?
Absolutely.
Finally, that's what my wife said. She said, you don't want to go there. They're so proud of their shitty little washing machine and everything. Okay, they have a little about Indians, a little about Métis, but otherwise it's just the pioneer stuff.
Yeah.
That's what she said.
The plains, the museum, I don't even know the name of it.
Mm-hmm.
The Prairie Museum or whatever they call it here on Cornell College in Albert. They've got an awful lot of artifacts that are never displayed. They're hidden.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is the case.
Yeah, Glenbow is just warehouses full.
Yeah, I know. And they're graveyards of native culture.
Yeah.
There's somebody called Jack Norton. He's a Hoopa Europe from Northern California. Like I said, I lived in California for a year. And once we did a field trip down to San Francisco, to the, I think, Lowy Museum it's called, that has the largest holding for California.
Mm-hmm.
And they showed us the archives, and they opened up, for example, the Hoopa people have this one dance, the white deerskin dance, where it's a renewal thing. It's very, very important for them.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And another one is the jump dance, where they have kind of headdresses that are made from about 200 each. woodpecker scalps,
okay,
the red parts.
Okay.
It's very elaborate.
Very, okay. Mm-hmm.
And those white deer skins, of course, they're very, very scarce. Mm-hmm. They're very sacred. Mm-hmm. They had about 20.
Oh, golly.
They just opened them, you know,
and said, look what we got.
And there were some Hoopa people in our group.
Uh-huh.
And they said, why can't you give it back? We've only got 11. We know from our elders there were 20 or 30 dancers, each of them carrying their on a, mounted on a stick and decorated. But there they were. No way.
Hmm. I went to Scotland. And I said, you got any coats? Matey coats.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Go downstairs, and I'm fairly tall, I'm 6 feet tall. I have to duck under the pipes and go in the old, kind of a dungy old hallway. They open a closet door, and on the floor is a few mothballs, and there's coats, like a rack of coats, matey coats. A whole rack of the darn things. Like there's more in that closet than there is in all of Canada right now, you know, sort of
where
the old
ones. Where was that, in Edinburgh?
Edinburgh. I went to Museum of Mankind in London. They had this tremendous, like they had the show called The Living Arctic at the time.
Uh-huh.
It's still on, in fact. And beautiful coats. Sure. I went to Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford, 50 miles away. They had a coat very, almost identical to the one, like very similar. It looked like the exact same person made it.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't even know each other's existed, you know, sort of thing like that. And that's ironic.
Well, a friend of mine, he's originally from the East Coast, Powhatan.
Okay.
From the very first people in around Jamestown that got into contact. And there's this, you know, the leader of the Powhatan Confederacy was called Powhatan, right?
Right.
The one that James Smith and other people dealt with, and the father of this almost legendary Pocahontas. Anyway, they've got in this one museum, which is part of one college in Oxford. They got something called Powhatan's mantle.
Mm-hmm.
It's an I see that's in the
Ashmolean Museum. Yeah.
Well, this friend of mine, Jack Forbes, who is a Powhatan, he's in California. He was in, as a scholar, he was in Oxford for 1 year, and he said, "Hartner, we went to visit." He said, "I want to show you something," and we went there, and he was just miserable.
Mm.
That's sad. And people are there, it's not even, it's in this old case, you can't even look at the
whole thing, because
the light reflects, you know, and it's there.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knows whether it's really Powhatan's mantle, but that's beside the point.
Yeah.
But there's so many things.
There was a lot of things.
Well, I can tell you other stories. Where I live, it's north of Hamburg, where I come from. Southern part is Holstein, you know, that's what Holstein cows are named
after. Okay, all right.
The whole area is called Schleswig-Holstein. North of us is Denmark. On the west coast is the North Sea. If you go across that, you come to England. On the east side is the Baltic.
Mm-hmm.
So you get to the Scandinavian countries. And the northern part is Schleswig. Southern part is Holstein, as I said. That's Saxon territory.
Mm-hmm.
To the north, there's still an area called Angeln. The people are called Angelita, that's Anglo. That's where the Anglo-Saxons and the Jutlanders that went over to England. That's where they come from.
Right,
so our old language is very close to English still. English is a mongrel language from so many different ways.
Right.
I don't mean that negative.
No, I know.
But
I know.
It's a mix.
Yeah, it's an evolutionary language.
Yeah, it's a combine of many things.
French, and, German,
and
all sorts of things.
And what they have in this one museum, they have some very nice... They have one big museum in Schleswig with a lot of stuff from maybe 2,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of things, relics or so, were preserved because they were put in the bog.
Right.
Because the people sacrificed and put things in the swampy areas because they're, well,
so they
that's where they worshipped, right?
Right.
So they were preserved and you get the bog people.
Right.
So there are some of the bog people that died 2,000 years ago, are on display there.
Right.
And I haven't really, when I talk to native people about this, they understand. If I talk to Germans about that, they just think I'm crazy, but I think they should be reinterred.
Mm-hmm.
It's obscene that we should be standing there and looking at our ancestors from 2,000 years ago.
That's what grossed me out more than anything. Yeah. When I went to the museums in London, Paris,
The mummies?
The mummies. The mummies, the skulls, the Maori heads, the shrunken heads.
Yeah.
I thought they...
Those were living people.
I said, they called us barbarians. You know, I said, yeah, that was my first thoughts, you know. Yeah. I was grossed out by all that.
Yeah,
I was feeling, to have a whole rack of skulls, like it's, what's the point? To have a rack of heads.
We're talking about skulls. There's a museum in Stockholm where they have one skull from maybe 2,000 to 2,500 years ago. And on that skull, there's scratches from scalping.
Is that right?
And the term scalp is a Scandinavian word. Scalp means just this part of the crane.
Right.
Talking about scalping.
Yeah. Well, it's been sort of said that the Indians got it going here. That's not true.
No, well, absolutely no.
It's the European.
And there's the proof.
Right, it's the European.
And it's the ones who commercialized it.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
There must be, I got a book when I was in, some lady put together an ethnographic collection of museums and of had ethnographic collections in Britain. I wrote away for it. I got 500 museums, a list of 500. So I've gone through it and I've hit with a highlighter about 70 that I see is really pertinent to my type of work. So I'm going to write letters or visit them hopefully someday if I can generate more funds and all that stuff. But I'm sure I've ran across references like Vienna has a museum.
I know somebody in Vienna who works there.
Right.
I'll give you the name, Christian Feast.
And
he's an ethnologist specializing on North America.
Really? Because I know every country has lots of pieces. And like
He once traveled around through Germany to all the shitty little museums because they might have something.
Right.
And like in Osnabrück, not on display, in the archives he found something from the plains, leggings and breastplates and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And he took pictures and he was trying to sort of find out what there is.
Uh-huh.
Now I'm not aware.